Good afternoon. You are listening to the Extended News at Noon on WISR 680 AM. I'm Tyler Friel. It's great to have you aboard here on this Monday, September 21st. It is the last day of summer, which means we're gearing up for the fall, and we've got a lot to get to today here on the Extended News at Noon, as we are joined by all three Butler County Commissioners. That's Commissioners Kim Geyer, Kevin Boozle, and Leslie Oshie. And also, later on in the program, we'll be talking to the new Bureau of Elections Director, that's Aaron Sheasley. And we're going to get into what has turned out to be a lot of conflicting messages all across the board in terms of mail-in ballots and what voting looks like in the middle of a pandemic. And so we're going to really dig into what you need to know for this upcoming fall election. So we got a lot to get to, and like we said, we appreciate you joining us here on the Afternoon News, and we appreciate the county commissioners coming in. Kim, Kevin, Leslie, thanks so much for stopping by.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot to get to, and I just want to start first of all with kind of where we are with coronavirus and COVID-19 in Butler County. Obviously, you guys are working with a number of parties and getting that communication from whether it's health officials or school officials. So, Leslie, I'll start with you. Your overall evaluation as we sit almost 6 months since the original shutdown and onset of the pandemic started.
So I think, you know, we continue to have weekly calls with the school districts. We continue to be in touch with the health officials, at particularly Butler Health System and UPMC via those calls. And I think everyone is really still just sort of doing all the things that they need to do to make sure that they're preventing the spread of the virus. It seems that the schools have opened pretty successfully. We've had no major challenges there. I know the university had a bit of an outbreak, but I think all things considered, everybody is back and operating, and things seem to be going fairly well from a general overview perspective.
Mm-hmm. And I know, and Kevin, I'll go to you on this, because CARES Act funding, you guys have received $17 million from the state to use for a variety of different reasons. What do county residents need to know what that $17 million is going to? How much are you allotting for businesses, nonprofits? How much are you allotting to county business in general? If you could kind of break down what we're looking at with that $17 million there.
Sure. I think it's important to know that this is funds that are not budgeted typically in your budget, and it's something that's because of the COVID, and it has to be spent by the end of the year.
Okay.
So all those things taken into effect, and then you have we set aside about $8 million, I think, for municipalities. Right. And we have a little under $4 million, probably a little over $4 million now distributed to those municipalities and townships and boroughs that have taken advantage of some of the things that we do business differently, right? I mean, you take a look at the way people come into the government offices, or how they're reacting online with forms and printing things and activity that way. So IT has shot through the roof, I would tell you, for most places, including the county government, as far as purchase of softwares and so on. And then, of course, you have the small business and nonprofits that are applying currently. We reminded people with small businesses, particularly I'd like to point out that originally, when the application went out, they were not eligible if they had EIDL funds or PPP funds. That has changed, so we can use our additional funds again, but it has to be exceeding what they received. They had to have spent all their PPP EIDL funds. So I can't remember. How much did we set aside for businesses?
There's one million.
Okay.
And $1.5 million for nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. So, and the nonprofits have kind of trickled in. I think that there's even townships. I saw a township turned in a bill for $48 for the whole CARES fund, and it's because especially some of these rural townships they're so used to being so frugal, and that's not a bad thing, but they have to understand. We've been working with a lot of these municipalities and managers of townships to educate them on what they could be using it for. So, for example, one township closed during the COVID epidemic, and so they were. I asked, "Well, how did you continue conduct business?" And so the one secretary said, "Well, I use my own personal computer at home." Well, that's not usually a good idea. Mm-hmm. So the recommendation was, "Why don't you buy a laptop or something that you can use both places?" So things like that, and making sure that they had Wi-Fi in certain areas and public access. So We've been being diligent. We use not only our own growth collaborative as part of that. We have a third party that looks over applications to make sure that we're in compliance. So I think we've been doing pretty well at getting that funding pushed out quickly as possible.
We have some flexibility. So for some reason, you know, one pot doesn't get exhausted, we can transfer it to another pot of money where there is more of a demand or a need.
Is there any – so when you say you have to use it by the end of the year, is there any chance that you can take that and set it aside for budget purposes, things that – some of the unknowns that are out there right now? It seems like taxes are the biggest. You know, what are our revenues going to be for 2020, and how is that going to impact our 2021 budget? Is there any things that you can do now to kind of set the table for next year?
We can't use this funding for
that.
It has to be expended and exhausted by the end of the year. And one of the conversations we're having now is the state, and what they're sitting on is about $1 billion. And they
that's
have
the federal funding?
Yes, federal funding that went through the state.
Okay.
And so, you know, I think what the state's looking at is, are they able to use that to recover lost funds? And if it's not the case, then they're going to, I'm assuming, would push it out to the counties, but we don't know that for sure. We're weighing in on that through the County Commissioners Association and some of the other entities that we work with to make sure that that funding does not get sent back to the federal government. We obviously need to use it here in the state.
And Kevin, you talked about the Growth Collaborative, and maybe Kim can speak to this as well. Was this somewhat of a byproduct of the past 6 months, or was the Growth Collaborative something that had been in the works previously?
The Growth Collaborative started when we came into office.
Okay.
And it was based on a study that had been done throughout the county where we recognized that, you know, all parties had to come together, all entities such as the community college, the tourism, the community development corporation, and many other organizations throughout the county come together and prioritize goals and objectives and priorities for the county. And it's overseen by Mark Gordon, who's our county's economic development director, and he's doing a fantastic job at facilitating the monthly meetings they have.
And what has been the reaction from business owners to you, especially over the last few months? Obviously, may have been a bit different at the onset of the pandemic in March and April and May. But what have business owners been telling you over the past few months? How are they doing?
I think they're just taking things day by day, because day by day for the past 6 months, the news is changing. The mandates are changing. The edicts are changing. The implications are changing for businesses. So on a day by day basis. So like them, we also are taking things day by day, and we're trying to adapt. And everybody's trying to adapt, and they're trying to adapt their businesses in a way where they can provide outdoor seating. They can make accommodations to be in compliance with the state and keep operating a business at the same time. So it's a day-by-day process, and we're here to support them in any way we can, whether it's through our Growth Collaborative or as commissioners. We're trying to get resources. We're trying to get funding to them, all the tools that they need to be successful and keep operating.
I know the last time we talked, which was probably in April or so, right around there, you guys collectively had expressed a little bit of frustration from that communication from the state level to the local level. Has anything changed in terms of that communication over the past few months from the governor's office to what they are telling you at the county level?
So I think the County Commissioners Association, after, you know, all these various actions taken, I think, have been able to achieve conversations with the governor's office and with the Department of Health and with PEMA on a weekly and regular basis. So I think there's opportunity there, an increased conversation. I suppose the gains, I mean, we're all going to differ in opinion on, you know, what is gained and what isn't gained in that conversation probably. But I think at least the fact that there's communication happening was certainly a step forward.
And where, and with that, let's go to the lawsuit, because, you know, the board here voted 2-1 to proceed with that lawsuit against Governor Wolf. Now, the latest that we have on that is the federal judge made the ruling that Governor Wolf's shutdowns were unconstitutional. So that has kind of put things in flux. People are wondering, okay, what can we do? What can't we do? Exactly. I mean, what's your interpretation? What have the attorneys told you as to what is legal in Pennsylvania right now?
Well, I think, you know, the two things that he said were, you know, first of all, the shutdowns were unconstitutional, and that the shutdown of businesses and the stay-at-home order. And then the second piece is the limits on gatherings and event gatherings. And so that pertains to mass gatherings and events in particular. So it really, any organization that is planning those or doing anything like that, all should contact their legal counsel and allow them to interpret, you know, what that means, and make sure they're consulting with them on those things. But I think it didn't mean that, and as the judge acknowledged, that all these things are done with good intention. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't say we should abandon common sense that says let's continue to wear the mask and make sure that we're taking care of our fellow, you know, citizens and doing our best to prevent the spread of a virus. But it does say, you know, these were actions that technically are unconstitutional.
And I think what the governor's counterpoint, or in what the counter argument seems to be, is, okay, who is then going to be making those decisions? Are, you know, local leaders? Does it get muddy whenever you're trying to decide who gets to make the decision about how many people can go to a football game?
Right.
Is that a local level? Should he have that power, that emergency responsibility in a time of crisis, to then go out and make that public health decision?
Mm-hmm. So I think what started this, and what the challenge really is that you had two state statutes, one relating to the disaster declaration and the powers that rest with the governor, and the powers that rest, I guess, locally with in declaring those declarations. The second is the public health statute. The difficulty is that I think those statutes were written at a time when nobody could have contemplated a situation that we are in right now. I don't think the disaster statute honestly contemplated it, that it would be used in a public health emergency situation necessarily. I think when you think of disaster, you think of you know, natural disasters, flood, fire, hurricane, you know, that sort of thing. So when you read that, you know, the part of that statute allows them to restrict access to areas or buildings or geographic areas, basically. That was the piece that was used as part of the shutdown. And so the business closures. And I'm not certain that, you know, when you read the statute itself, that really that was the intent of that statute. You would think that you're closing an area off, or a geographic area, or a building off because it's unsafe for some reason, structurally unsafe, or there's some threat. So I don't know that that was the intent. And then
this
challenge
is one of the places we disagree.
Okay, yeah, and that's what, you know. Yeah.
And then the challenge became so. You know, the Pennsylvania Constitution gives the governor the veto power. So any move, so in that disaster statute, it also says the legislature has the power to stop the disaster declaration, or cease it, I guess, if you will, or not renew it, essentially. However, you know, then the state Commonwealth Court ruled, well, because he has veto power, that has no effect. So there are some challenges, I think, inherent in these statutes at the state level, and whether or not, you know, you can do those things and still comply with the Constitution, United States Constitution, you know, I think is what is in question.
And Kevin, you from the outset of the lawsuit voted not to move forward with it. What was your explanation for that, your rationale, and what's your stance on the situation now?
So you remember our first conversation here and the frustration we felt, and all this was coming down, and we're asking for information. There's two things you need to make a decision. You need time, you need the data. I don't think they had enough time to gather the data to make great decisions, so they did broad brush, right? So when it came down to the lawsuit, we talked about it. Without having that communication available to us, it was a real problem. We could see that coming on the horizon. And so we leaned on the governor and DOH and Pima for that interactive ability. And we were able to receive that to some extent with DOH and intergovernmental through the state. So, and then long term, a couple weeks later, we were able to get into weekly or biweekly calls, every other week calls with the governor and Dr. Levine. And so that was the communication we were aiming for, to be able to have that conversation. Now, as far as the orders go and not being able to anticipate what the governor was going to do, my disagreement in that is back in early 2000, we planned for pandemics. We planned for H1N1. We did point of distribution for mass vaccinations. We talked about how that would play out. Now, what I think happened was legislatively, our reps didn't maybe comprehend where this could go. And as Lizzie said, who knew that you'd have veto power on top of everything else? It was an odd time. But I can say that, you know, intentions were good that they did this. I think that in the middle of a pandemic, it's very difficult to litigate, right? When legislation should be done, we're in litigation instead, and that makes it very difficult for us as a local body to work with the state, who's also trying to figure it out. So when you look up, you expect to get answers. When you look up, they were figuring it out. So that's kind of where we were left to holding the ball. So, you know, at the end of the day, because I was able to have that communication for us as Butler County and also for CCAP, I felt that the we're on the right track, that we can now balance between what we needed to do and what they were willing to offer. So,
and I think, too, as people, one of the big sticking points for the lawsuit, especially at the last public meeting, was who's paying for this lawsuit. Now, the county, in addition with Green, Washington, and Fayette, they were dismissed as plaintiffs in that lawsuit. So the current, basically, who's paying for the lawsuit is what people want to know, and what's the county's involvement with it now? Because technically, they are dismissed in their role as a plaintiff in that particular case.
Yeah, with this decision under Section 1983, the legal fees are to be paid by the prevailing party, and in this case, they would be paid by the Commonwealth, and so we will be seeking payment by the Commonwealth. So that the taxpayers of Butler County will not be incurring the fees associated with this lawsuit. So
just so I'm hearing you correctly, because in your particular case, even though you were dismissed as a plaintiff,
correct,
because the Commonwealth did not win that case, the Commonwealth is then on the hook for the money?
So your taxpayers are still going to pay, but just different way.
Right.
I mean, that's the reality.
So the state is still going to pay for it.
The tax paid both sides of the argument.
The governor's team.
I think then, especially from the viewpoint of the people who were, you know, at that meeting, and the counter argument against this suit is, okay, what are we gaining out of this? Is essentially, I think, what they're asking is, as county residents, okay, you know, we're ruling this unconstitutional, but I'm also on the hook for a lawsuit, and I don't quite know what I'm getting out of it, other than maybe a precedent being set, which is a fair and, you know, legitimate viewpoint. But there's, you know, people out there wondering exactly who that check's getting cut out to.
I would expect more litigation because of the stay order that the governor's requesting, and where that goes, I don't know. And on the appeal, who funds that? I don't know who's going to fund that.
Yeah, and we're looking now. We have received a number, I guess, of calls over the last 3-4 days. From some legal defense funds that are interested in providing the funding to see that go forward. It gained national attention and national traction, and so there are people looking to help to help fund this going forward, simply because it's a constitutional issue that many people are concerned about and many people mm-hmm. care about. And as business owners who are family, so many of ours were family business owners who have been doing this all their lives, and these were things that were critical to them, and they came to us. And, you know, when this started, the whole goal, you know, when the whole COVID, you know, disaster began, the goal was to keep our hospitals, and we were very clear when we did our declaration, it was to keep the hospital from being overrun. But I think as time wore on, and this continued and continued, I think that's when the question comes into play, like, this could continue indefinitely. Mm-hmm. COVID or no COVID, if they can keep renewing that declaration, this continues indefinitely, and people whose livelihoods are being affected, whose lives and livelihoods are affected now. Negatively, terribly negatively impacted. So I think those who felt that their rights were being violated, I mean, again, remember, we attempted on multiple occasions, we wrote letters, we did all of those things, and when we reached that point where it seemed we could go no other route, I mean, you could stand in the street and say, you know, terrible things like any other politician and yell at each other mm-hmm. if you want to, or you can take the only route that's left, and that was, you know, as far as our perspective was, the legal route was the only route left. So for a business owner, I think they got a return on their tax dollars, definitely. And so did those individuals who were concerned about their rights to make a decision about whether I should stay at home or whether I can continue to function normally with certain precautions in play.
Now, overall, especially with a lawsuit like this, this does right now set a precedent of mm-hmm. the emergency powers of the governor of Pennsylvania. That's a pretty tall task in terms of setting the table. What's your view as what the power a governor should have and the power you guys as county commissioners should have? Because there does seem to be – the biggest question was, what decisions do I get to make locally seem to be what's at play here and what will be at play moving forward?
Well, county government's the level of government closest to the people. And so while this lawsuit went on to say, and we also had some detractors at the last public meeting that went on to suggest that because we are – the counties are a creature of the state, we were dismissed from the lawsuit. And so while we are creatures of the state, we also have a responsibility as commissioners to listen to our constituents who were communicating to us that they were being harmed. And so we asserted ourselves on their behalf and advocated as a county because their businesses were being adversely harmed and affected.
And interestingly, there was three businesses that argued not to file the lawsuit that were saying that you shouldn't take this on as a county. So we were listening to everyone's opinion, like not just go for it, not to stay away from it. This is how government works. You have to make choices, right? And they're all not always popular on either side, and they're hard to make. But what I've learned from this process, if nothing else, is that this is a once-in-a-lifetime event, thank God, and that we have to compartmentalize that because we have 99,000 other pieces of government business we have to keep moving. And so we have done, you know, while we disagree on many parts of this, mm-hmm. absolutely 100%, I think it's important to know that county government doesn't stop. We don't stand in the street and yell at each other. We were being very cordial to each other because, you know, while tensions are high, we're doing your business as a taxpayer.
We still have to come through it.
We have,
as noted, we've got lots of other important things happening, whether elections it's on transportation, whether it's transportation or elections or, you know, things that really matter to people here close to home. Those things need to continue to move forward. As Kim indicated, the Growth Collaborative, we attended the opening of a new business RPP, you know, this past mm-hmm. week. And, you know, there are businesses still coming to the county. There's lots of good news to be shared. So I think that's the case. You're just kind of dealing with that within the context of everything else that's going on to to that credit.
So again, just to recap, and we'll leave it here with the lawsuit, it's currently the governor, if I'm correct, requested a stay. Mm-hmm. So that will go to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we're at right now.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
All right. We'll leave it there. I also want to talk transportation here for just a few more moments, as the county was the recipient of a major grant to help with the continued development of the Route 228 corridor. Kim, that's your neck of the woods, and it's just been a continued growth of that area.
Well, you know, people say, well, why 228? Why are you guys always focusing on that, not other roads? We are focusing on other road systems and transportation and bridges throughout the county. But as far as 228 goes, there is no other corridor that transports over $30 billion worth in GDP annually across that corridor that can compare in Butler County. It's a regional corridor. That's why we call it the Gateway 228 Project. And believe it or not, we were awarded the highest amount in the nation next to two projects in Texas. So we're quite proud. We had SPC director there, Vincent Valdez, who is the new director of SPC, Southwestern Pennsylvania Commission. And he went on to say, you know, if you get one of these build grants in a lifetime, that's a monumental thing. To get two in within 3 years is just extraordinary. And I have to agree. And Commissioner Oshie had also received some additional news on Thursday from Deputy Secretary of the State PennDOT, Larry Shiflett, and I'll let her share that.
Well, I think what we've found is that the remaining amount of the money that will be needed for the construction of that section of roadway has been placed on the tip, the transportation plan for the second 4 years coming. So by the time we actually get to the point where that grant is let, or where that project is let, so to speak, the funding will be in place from the state level. So our local contribution may decrease a bit based on that. So that was good news to know that, you know, that's going to be there, and it will free up our local use fee dollars to be put to some more local projects here, hopefully in the center part of the county. We did some north, we did some south, and, you know, now I'm cheering for the middle. I want the middle, right?
And Tyler, I think one of the reasons why we were successful in getting this is because of the local commitment.
Right.
You know, we talked about 34%, and several of the townships stood up with a couple million each. Mm-hmm. But we were still looking at 10 to 16 million from county funds. And so that what Leslie Oshie's talking about is a huge lift off of that requirement. Mm-hmm. But had we not went in with it, and it's a hard decision, right? I mean, we're investing in state infrastructure, but it's in our local area, so it's a tough decision to make, and it's a hard pill to swallow, but it's necessary. And now we're here, and the state's stepping up, and I'm very happy to see them do that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the first person that I went to see was the budget director, was Ann Brown, and said, "Good news, Ann." and so she was certainly relieved to hear that. And I think, you know, it takes collaboration not only at the local level to make that happen, and thanks to those municipalities who stepped up and were willing, you know, to help put some money on the table to get this done. But I think regionally, you know, as everyone has indicated and Kim indicated, the work through the Southwest PA Commission and the fact that we are, you know, able to regionally cooperate and continue to advocate for funds that will come back to the Southwest PA region, because, you know, we have been dramatically underfunded, I think, in Southwest Pennsylvania, particularly when it relates to PennDOT Spike Fund. So we've been making that case collectively, all the counties in Southwest PA, with legislators and with the leadership, and hopefully we'll bring more dollars back to Southwest PA.
We'll take a short break. On the other side of our break, we're going to be getting into election talk. Director of Elections Aaron Cheesley will join us, along with the commissioners as well. You are listening to the Extended News at Noon on WISR 680 AM.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location downtown Butler to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Welcome back to the Extended News at Noon on WISR 680 AM. I'm Tyler Frio with you. Commissioner Kevin Boozle having to run off to a meeting, so Leslie Oshie, Kim Geyer, they stick around. Aaron Sheasley is the new Director of Elections for the county. How many months, weeks onto the job are you?
Started at the end of July, July 27th, so a couple of months.
Picked a good time to get into the election business, huh?
Well, I've been in it for a long time, but yeah, for this capacity, it's coming in between the primary and the general is definitely an interesting thing.
And this has been widely discussed, starting with the president, the whole way down to neighborhoods and municipalities as to exactly, and the focus has been on Pennsylvania, too. And Pennsylvania figures to play a key role here in the 2020 presidential election. But, of course, we're talking about a number of state house races, local races, congressional races, and people want to know how to vote during a pandemic. Want to focus on mail-in ballots here from the get-go. There's been a lot of talk, a lot of rumors and everything going online about exactly what I need to do for a mail-in ballot. So if you could, I don't want to say the Reader's Digest version, but if you're a voter out there and you're wondering, okay, I don't want to go to the polls in person, I would like to vote via mail, what are the steps that I need to take?
So just to be clear on that, we have 89 polling precincts in Butler County, and they will all be open on Election Day. So there's that. But the process for mail-in balloting is you first have to request an application. And Butler County does not send out any unsolicited mailings with applications or anything. So you have to go onto the state's website, or you have to go onto the county website and fill out a form, which then can get transmitted electronically to us, or you can drop it in the mail to us.
Okay.
Once we receive that form, then we go through and we make sure that the person's registered to vote. We make sure that the person meets the criteria. You know, everything's filled out correctly. And if it's not, we'll send the application back, you know, to make sure that, you know, that happens. And we got all the correct information in. And then it gets keyed into the state, the database. So then what happens after that is, now that the ballot has been approved, we have a final candidate list that a lot of other states were able to get the ballot process moving a little earlier. We had the Green Party lawsuit that was holding up the final candidate list. That was resolved on the 17th. So now that we're at that point, now that we have a candidate list, what we have to do now is adjust all of our ballots to make sure that everybody is appropriately on the list. We had to remove the Green Party candidates. And it's not as simple as just, you know, clicking delete or anything. It's a complicated process. So if you received your you filled out your application for mail-in ballot, and you'll get an email back saying you've been approved. And then you basically you'll get an envelope in the mail. It's a larger envelope. It'll say official ballot material in there. And then basically, after that, you open it up. You're going to have some instructions in there. Your ballot's in there. A secrecy envelope is in there. And a return envelope. And for this election only, the state is paying the postage for that to come back in. So you'll fill out your mail-in ballot. You'll put it in the secrecy envelope, and that's a critical component here because one of the things that the recent court case laid out is that if it's not received in that secrecy envelope, it won't count when it gets back to us. So it's important that you do that. And then it all goes into a return envelope then, and on the back of that envelope is a signature line. There's a barcode that's unique to each person. And what you're signing then is an affidavit saying that, you know, you are entitled to vote. This is your one vote. And then you can either do one of two things. You can drop it in the mail, or you can bring it to the Butler County Elections Bureau. And then that is considered your vote.
Okay. And so the Elections Bureau is inside the county government center, correct?
Yes, we're on the lower level.
Okay. So people are thinking, all right, so I got to basically put this ballot into two envelopes, right? The secret envelope and then the return envelope. I can put it in the mail. and I'm good to go. Will they get confirmation that their vote has been counted?
Yes.
Okay.
The purpose of the barcode being on the envelope, well, the purpose of the secrecy envelope is so that when we start receiving all of these materials back, there is a locked room within the election bureau. There's only two keys to that room. I have one, and the other one is maintained by our solicitor in his office. So when those ballots come back, there is no way they can be touched. Now, the purpose of the secrecy envelope is to make sure that when we start doing things on election morning, there's no way to see anybody's ballot to see who they voted for. It's designed as a safety measure to prevent any partisan, you know, my office is nonpartisan. We don't have anything to do with, you know, any particular candidate. So
it disconnects the identity. So you can't identify that particular ballot with whomever might have submitted that ballot.
Correct.
That's the purpose of the secrecy envelope.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
Right. So then, you know, once you get all that stuff back here, we'll scan that barcode, and that barcode will trigger an email saying an automatic email process that your ballot has been received. It was received on time, and it has been counted.
When in terms of when they need to get that vote in by. I know there was a new decision as well that was released by the state. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure.
As well?
The deadline for ballots was 8 o'clock on election night. They had to be in the Bureau of Elections. And we have a time and date stamp machine that as soon as you bring things in, we'll scan it in and you'll get a time and date stamp. And as long as that's before 8 o'clock, you're good. And that's timed with the closing of the polls. So that's why that time is specifically. So then the most recent court ruling allowed that if your ballot is postmarked by 8 o'clock on election night, we can receive it through Friday, so 3 days. We can receive it through Friday at the end of the business day for us, which is 4:30 p.m. on Friday. So as long as it's postmarked by election night at 8 o'clock and received by Friday at 4:30, it will count and be tabulated.
So theoretically, if I put my ballot in the mail on that Monday at 4 o'clock or whenever the mail comes picked up, it may not necessarily be in your office by the next day, but as long as it gets there within those three-day span, it will be counted?
Yes.
Okay.
It all comes down to the postmark. As long as it's postmarked by 8 o'clock on election night, and many post offices are staying open or they have additional hours or additional things, as long as it has that postmark and as long as it's by that time, it will count.
And I want to go to the commissioners here too, because and Aaron started in July. You were all there for a mail-in ballot election in the primary of,
right,
what, 24,000 applications or so?
Right, and it was a massive undertaking. So we're well ahead of that at this point in time. I mean, we have many, many more requests for mail-in ballots this time. So, you know, now it'll remain to be seen how many people actually go to the poll versus actually mailing in the ballot. But I think what's really important is that once you get the ballot, the sooner you get it back, the better. Because what will happen is if we don't, first of all, if you wait, you know, getting an accurate count and being able to deliver results could take days. You're not going to see potentially the result on election night. It's definitely going to be a very preliminary count, you know, on election night. And at the same time, you know, we started canvassing those ballots at 7 a.m. on election day, the mail-ins, and it took till almost midnight to finish it all.
You
remember,
up.
Yeah, it was 11 o'clock by the time I think the count finished, and we got maybe final numbers at 11:30, something. It was late.
Was there – do you have any ability to count those ballots earlier? Was that part thrown out in the state ruling?
Yeah. Our ability begins at 7 a.m. on election day.
Okay.
So there's nothing – we're not allowed to touch those ballots in that locked room
until –
yeah. Correct.
Okay. I know there's been a lot of controversy surrounding mail-in ballots. Would you two commissioners and Aaron, basically, what is your opinion? Is this a safe and effective way for people to vote?
I think having two options, you've always had it. You know, you've always had it with the absentee. So it's always existed. I think they're trying to make it a little bit easier. And under the circumstances, there's been, you know, a lot of promotion for mail. So I think you have two options, and I think we can get it done. And we certainly did backflips, if you will, to try to make sure that the primary was conducted fairly, that we did, you know, as much as we could to make sure that people had their opportunity to vote and that the ballots came in and they got counted and we produced results that night. And I think we'll do the same in the general election. And mm-hmm. I think we can assure you that no matter which way you choose to vote, you're voting safely and your vote will get counted. But I think we all have to remember that we do have a little bit of personal responsibility in this process, you know, to try to get your ballot timely, you know, submitted and, you know, follow the instructions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To make every effort to follow those instructions to make sure that if you do your part, we can do our part and we can get a result effectively.
And people have been concerned about voter fraud. Aaron, you've been in the election business. Is this a concern that people should have? Like, oh, if I send my ballot in, maybe it will be defrauded. Somebody from the post office can take this. What's the actual percentage chance of that happening?
Very, very small. The purpose of like the secrecy envelope, it's basically just an envelope that, you know, that your ballot goes into, but it's designed so that nobody handling that mail can have any idea whatsoever who you're voting for. So as Commissioner Oshie said, it separates, you know, the person from the vote, you know. So when we tabulate everything, you know, there's no way to, you know, that anybody could have any kind of a preference or anything. And as I said before, my office is completely nonpartisan.
You know, I think the big confusion right now is that we're all getting barraged with mailers from third parties. So what you're getting are interest groups or political campaigns or groups who are sending out mail-in ballot applications on both sides, on all, mm-hmm. you know, all everyone, you know, is doing that. And people are mistaking that for a ballot. I had so many people, even in the primary, who, as I was out at the polls that day, were really upset because they said they received a ballot in the mail. I said, you did not receive a ballot in the mail from our election bureau. You received an application from a third party. And people, I bet I might have got four in my mailbox yesterday. Mm-hmm. So what you need to understand is that, and they do direct you to the Votes PA website.
And will you, so let's say you put in mm-hmm. your mail-in ballot, you're not going to stop getting these mailers, correct?
No.
They'll just keep coming because there's no way those third parties would know that you have actually voted.
Right. I actually have a file that I talk to a lot of Butler County voters throughout the course of a day and the course of a week. And one of the most common questions I get, you know, why am I getting all this in the mail? Because if you look at the return address on these things, it's actually the Butler County Election Bureau. Because what the super PACs and the candidates on both sides have done, they've gone out to the state's website and they've downloaded the official form to request a mail-in ballot. It's an application form. And then they've wrapped their own marketing or whatever literature around it and then sent it out. So, I personally have gotten probably five different things in the mail. But the important thing to know is that if you send one of those in, you're only going to get one ballot. You could fill out all five of them, but you're only going to get one ballot because right. we have safeguards and we have ways to catch those things built into the process so that you will have one person, one vote.
So if you do get a mailer, though, that has an application on it, you can fill that out as your application to receive a mail-in ballot?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
It serves as a legitimate form. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
They've downloaded the actual form from the state, and then they've just kind of packaged it a little differently. But the form itself, it's the correct form, right?
And something else I think people should know, too, is that – and to point out when you – if you get a mail-in ballot and you go to the poll – you actually, you know, normally when you go to – you sign in, you know how you have to put your signature in there mm-hmm. that you're checking in at the poll. If you were sent – if you applied for a mail-in ballot and you were sent a ballot, there will be no signature line by your name. So that's how, you know, that's the quick indication, and it's very clear, very clear in those poll books. And it's a clear indication to the judge of elections and the poll workers that, you know, you have received a mail-in ballot. And so, therefore, if you go to the poll, technically you would have to vote provisionally then, which just means that you're using the same ballot, but it will go in a provisional envelope. So what that allows us to do, or what allows the Election Bureau to do when your ballot comes back in provisionally, is it checks. You have that system of check and balances. And that's the beauty of the paper ballots, is that, you know, you definitely can check whether or not somebody has already voted. So I have to say, I was kind of unsure and scratched my head when we moved to this whole paper ballot system, but based on what we've witnessed in the last, you know, year and a half, you have a clear paper trail, auditable paper trail, in terms of making sure that, you know, we don't have people duplicating votes.
So those are issues that kind of get thrown out there, but you would say legitimately with your elections office that if the average voter should not be concerned about people voting twice or illegally voting or stuffing ballots or something like that.
Correct. That's exactly right. Yeah, very well said. There are a lot of safety measures built in, and there are a lot of catches so that we would be able to figure out whether that happened or not. And before I was in this position, I was a judge of elections in Cranberry Township, so I'm familiar with how everything works, from a poll worker perspective. And we don't want to disenfranchise anyone's opportunity to vote. So if there's any question about anything, you fill out a provisional ballot. And then when it comes back to us at the end of the day in the Election Bureau, then we will be able to see if you've voted in another way, or if you've returned a form. A lot of people have requested mail-in ballots, filled out the application, and then decided to go to the polling location because they thought it was safe to do so. And then so they're on that list of people who received that ballot. So they have to vote provisionally. And then at the end of the day, we'll be able to tell whether they turned that ballot in. And then we'll also have their provisional ballot. And then only one of those will count.
And, of course, you can still vote in person.
Absolutely.
What is a pandemic voting world going to look like?
Yeah. And in the primary, being out in the Cranberry Township precinct that I was judge of elections in, we're asking everybody to wear masks, social distancing. We have plexiglass shields that are portable now that we've gotten from the state to protect the poll workers. Mm-hmm. Hand sanitizer. We bought a large number of pens so that everybody gets their own pen. It's a single-use thing, so nobody's, touching things more than once. The ballot is only handled by the voter. It's put into the machine by the voter, and then the machines are cleaned at different intervals throughout the day. You know, when you fill out your ballot, you're in a little there's little I voted boxes. It's a secrecy
cubicle.
Area,
cubicle, like a
more or less. And those are even sanitized multiple times throughout the course of the day, and that's just to keep everybody safe. And a lot of people, a lot of people I talk to, they want to come out and they want to vote. So, like I said, all 89 precincts will be open on Election Day.
Are you looking for poll workers?
We have had probably 450 additional volunteers.
Really?
For poll workers in Butler County, just between the primary and now. I think September 1st was National Poll Worker Day, so it went out across a lot of social media platforms. So we're seeing a lot of people volunteering for the first time, and a lot of them are younger people, which is great. Just getting involved in the process, and so we're in the we're going through that list right now and trying to make sure that we have places for everyone. But we have no shortage.
You talk to political science professors, analysts. They caution that you may not know the result of this election on election night. Of course, here in Pennsylvania, if you're still accepting ballots, 3 days postmarked after the election, with Pennsylvania playing a role that figures to be very key in a presidential election, would you make that same warning to people that come Wednesday, November 4th, we may not know who the president is?
Well, I think we need to start, you know, throughout the course of history, we've had election day. And I think really starting now, we're looking at like an election week because of the pandemic and the way things are changing and those three additional days. It's quite possible that we won't have a final tally until the end of the week.
So we may just be sitting here in a number of local races.
Sure.
When you and I just thought of this because you said pens. When you fill out a mail-in ballot, does it have to be pen or can it be pencil?
The instruction sheet that goes out with everything, it's blue or black pen.
Okay.
Yeah, and the machines that we use to read them can read either one, but yeah, that's fine.
So it's like the opposite of the SAT. You don't need the
number two
pencil. You can use black or blue pen.
Please don't use a number two pencil, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything, Aaron Cheesley is the director of elections for Butler County. Is there anything else that you'd like our listeners to know prior to this year's election?
You know, I think we've got right about 40,000 right now people have requested mail-in ballots, filled out the applications. They have until October 27th to keep filling out those forms.
Okay.
So we're looking at a large number. Just, you know, have patience, you know, and when you get your ballot in the mail, don't wait. Fill it out, get it right back in the mail, and send it in. And other than that, I believe, you know, we're looking at everything. There's a lot of moving parts in an election like this. But everything's going according to our plans, and you know we're backup plans and everything. So I think I'm looking forward to it, and I think it's going to be a good thing. But don't stay up too late on election night thinking you're going to find some results. I think it's probably the best guidance.
Commissioner Leslie Oshie, Commissioner Kim Geyer, thank you both for coming in.
Thank you, Tom.
If you have missed today's interview or any portion of it, you can catch it online at WISR680.com. Big thanks to Pat Parker back on the board. You will catch, we've got Extended News at Noon coming up tomorrow as well with Tracy Morgan, and you are listening to WISR 680 AM.